You can actually break your neck on a hockey rink moving at the speed of a slow walk.
Yeah. It's a completely sobering reality.
Right, because it just defies physics. Or, well, it defies common sense anyway. I mean, we all imagine these catastrophic injuries happening when two massive players collide at, 25 miles an hour in open ice.
Exactly. That's the highlight reel hit.
But the truth is, the most devastating structural damage to the human body often happens at, 3 miles an hour, pinned against the boards, and it's all because of one tiny, almost invisible biomechanical mistake a player makes while trying to protect a 6 ounce piece of rubber.
It really is.
Think it.
And it fundamentally changes how you have to approach the sport. I mean, if your mental model of hockey is just, skate fast and shoot hard, you were completely missing the invisible architecture of the game.
The invisible architecture. I like that.
Right. And
Love
that
it.
architecture is built entirely on possession.
And that is exactly what we are stripping down to the studs today. We are taking a deep dive into the microscopic details of puck control.
Because it's not just about fancy moves.
No, not at all. Our mission here isn't to give you a couple of quick tips for your Tuesday night beer league or, to rattle off a list of practice drills.
Yeah.
We want to build a permanent, integrated mental framework.
A masterclass level understanding, really.
Exactly. We want to look at how a player actually manipulates the puck, how that physical manipulation dictates their field of vision, how that vision dictates their tactics, and how all of it sits on this crazy knife's edge of physical safety and rulebook geometry.
Because, I mean, if you strip away the systems, right? The neutral zone traps, the power play formations, all of that. Hockey just boils down to time and space.
Just time and space.
Yeah. And puck handling is the currency you use to buy that time. It buys the half second where literally every other tactical decision becomes possible.
Right, because if you can't control the puck, none of the strategy matters.
Exactly. Think about it. You could understand the game tactically perfectly. You could have off-the-charts hockey IQ. You know exactly where the passing lanes are. But all of that is entirely useless if your hands betray you the millisecond the puck touches your blade.
The tactical game just does not exist for a player who cannot control the puck. Okay, let's unpack this from the very bottom up.
Where do you want to start?
I want to start at the absolute micro level, like the physical connection between the human body and the composite stick. Because before we can talk about seeing the ice or deceiving a defender, we have to talk about the physics of a lever.
Oh, the lever, yes.
Right. When I hold a hockey stick, I have two hands on it. But they are not doing the same job, are they?
No, they're doing entirely opposite jobs. And honestly, confusing those roles is the single most common failure point for any player learning the game.
Okay, so break that down for us.
So you have the top hand, the one capping the butt end of the stick. If you shoot left-handed, that's your right hand. The top hand is the steering
The
wheel.
steering wheel, okay.
Right. It is the control center. The kick dictates the angle of the blade, the roll of the wrists, the sweeping motion across the ice. The bottom hand sitting further down the shaft is just a passenger.
Just a passenger.
Yeah, its primary job is just to be a loose guide, a stabilizer.
See, I always visualize the stick as a crowbar. Like, if you're trying to pry open a heavy crate, the top hand at the very end of the crowbar is applying all the rotational force. It's the fulcrum of your leverage.
That is a perfect analogy.
And the further down you place your other hand, the more stability you have. But if that bottom hand grips the crowbar like a vise, you suddenly lock the entire lever into
Right,
place.
you can't pivot, you can't maneuver.
Exactly. And that's the trap players fall into,
Oh,
right?
all the time, they get nervous, the game speeds up, a defender approaches, and their survival instinct just screams at them to grip the stick harder to protect it.
Right. They white knuckle it.
Exactly, they white knuckle the bottom hand. And the moment you squeeze that bottom hand, you kill the stick's ability to rotate. Coaches refer to this as losing your soft hands.
Soft hands.
Yeah, because if your bottom hand is clamped down, the shaft cannot slide. The top hand cannot roll the blade over the puck, and your stick essentially just becomes a rigid block of wood.
But wait, let me challenge that mechanical premise for a second.
Okay, up for it.
If my bottom hand is sliding loosely up and down the shaft, if I am literally holding it like a delicate bird, which is what the coaching manuals suggest, how on earth do I survive physical contact?
Oh, all right.
Like, if a 220-pound defenseman comes down with a heavy stick lift or just hacks at my shaft to strip the puck, a loose grip means my stick goes flying into the netting. I have to squeeze it to be strong on the puck, don't I?
So you're touching on a really vital nuance of the mechanics here. The grip is dynamic, it's not static.
Dynamic hat.
The bottom hand is loose 90% of the time. It allows the shaft to slide seamlessly as you push the puck out wide or pull it in tight. But in the specific fraction of a second, when an opposing stick makes contact, or, you know, when you need to dig a puck out of a heavy board battle, that bottom hand clamps down.
Oh, I see.
Right? It tightens to establish a rigid frame, absorbs the impact, wins the leverage battle, and then, and this is the real secret, it instantly releases back into a loose ring.
Okay, so it's an adaptive tension. Squeeze for impact, release for manipulation.
Precisely. Because if it stays clamped after the impact, yeah, you win the stick battle, but you immediately lose the puck. You can't cup the blade to retrieve it.
Cupping the blade. Let's dive into that, because a hockey puck is this heavy, flat piece of vulcanized rubber, right? And it's on a freezing, frictionless surface.
And modern composite stick blades are incredibly stiff.
Exactly. So if the puck hits a flat vertical blade, it just ricochets off like a super ball.
Which is exactly why the top hand's wrist flexibility is the engine of all puck control. When you handle a puck, your blade cannot just sit at a perfect 90-degree angle to the ice.
It has to lean, right?
Yeah, it must lean over the top of the puck. It creates this small, angled pocket that traps the rubber between the ice and the composite face.
So you're crapping it.
Right. You have to roll your top wrist forward to cup the forehand, and then dramatically roll it backward to cup the backhand. This rolling action has to be continuous.
If you watch a pro in slow motion, it's wild.
It really is. Their blade is constantly opening and closing, trapping the puck on both sides of that sweeping motion.
And you physically cannot execute that backhand wrist roll if your bottom hand is strangling the shaft.
No, it is anatomically impossible. A tight bottom hand locks the forearm pronation, which means your backhand blade stays vertical and the puck just rolls up the tape and flips away.
So when coaches see a player whose puck is constantly bouncing over their stick on the backhand, they don't even look at the blade, do they?
Nope. They look straight at the bottom hand grip. Every single time.
So what should we remember here about the basic grip?
The golden rule is simple. Top hand steers, bottom hand slides. You hold the stick like a bird, not a baseball bat.
Top hand steers, bottom hand slides. Got it.
Hmm.
Now, I want to look at the positioning of these hands relative to the body, because I see a posture at the rink all the time that completely breaks this lever system we just talked about. I call it the T-Rex posture.
Oh, I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah, the player has their top hand practically glued to their own hip or their stomach, like little T-Rex arms.
Yeah, the technical term in coaching circles is hip lock, and it is the most detrimental postural habit a player can build.
Why do they do it then?
Well, when a player is anxious, they naturally want the puck close to their center of gravity. They pull their top hand into their hip. They bury their elbow into their ribs. It feels safe, you know?
Yeah.
It feels compact and protected.
But structurally, it's terrible.
It is structurally the most vulnerable position on the ice.
Because of the geometry it forces on the blade.
Exactly. If your top hand is pinned to your right hip, the stick shaft points straight down, which means the blade can only operate in this tiny, narrow corridor directly in front of your skates.
You've handcuffed yourself.
You have entirely handcuffed yourself.
Yeah.
And if the puck is directly in front of you, well, it is also directly in front of the defender facing you.
Oh, right. You have no lateral reach.
None. You cannot pull the puck to the side to protect it. Every single stick check the defender throws will hit the puck, because you have basically placed a puck directly in their easiest line of attack.
So to fix that geometry, we have to decouple the lever from the body. We have to push that fulcrum out into space.
Right. You take that top hand and you push it out, away from your chest. You want at least a fist's distance, if not more, between your top glove and your torso, with your elbow slightly bent, totally free from your ribs.
And unlocking that top hand suddenly turns the stick from a rigid cane into this massive, sweeping compass.
It really does. It unlocks an incredible radius. From that extended top hand position, you can roll the wrists to pull the puck far outside your left skate, sweep it way out in front of you, and drag it entirely outside your right skate, all without even moving your torso.
And crucially, it unlocks the one-handed extension, right?
Yes, the one-handed extension.
Let's explore that, because it looks like a desperation move when a beginner does it, but it's like a surgical tool for an expert.
When you have the top hand extended off the body and the bottom hand is loose like we talked about, you can simply let go with the bottom hand entirely.
Just drop it.
Exactly. The top arm straightens, pushing the stick out to its absolute maximum length. You instantly add the length of your forearm and shoulder to your reach.
That's a huge distance.
It's massive. You use this to snag a loose puck that is 6 feet away, or to drag the puck completely out of the reach of a sprawling defender. It shouldn't be a panic reflex, though. It should be a practiced, deliberate expansion of your radius.
You reach, cup the puck, pull it back into your feet, and the bottom hand naturally catches the shaft again as it returns.
Precisely. It's fluid.
Which brings up the actual movement of the puck within that radius.
Mm.
A lot of players just get out there and aggressively chop the puck back and forth, side to side in front of them. You know, it sounds impressive, that rapid fire tapping on the ice.
Right. But the rapid fire side to side dribble is a complete trap.
Why is it a trap?
Because it is a rhythm. And rhythm is predictable.
Ah.
Yeah, if a defender watches you go left, right, left, right, left, right, their brain subconsciously maps the cadence. They know exactly where the puck will be half a second in the future, and they simply put their stick in that spot.
So how do you break that predictability?
You have to master the extremes of your radius. You need wide dribbles and tight dribbles, and you really need to break the lateral plane entirely.
Let's break down the mechanics and the risks of those wide and tight dribbles then. I imagine a wide dribble, like a massive sweeping pull outside your feet, is fantastic for getting around a static object, but terrible for actually protecting the rubber.
You're right. A wide dribble exposes the puck. When you push the puck 3 feet outside your skates, it is super vulnerable to a poke check from any angle.
So why do it?
Because its purpose isn't protection. Its purpose is manipulation. A wide dribble forces the defender to physically turn their skates and shift their weight to track it.
And once their weight shifts.
Exactly. Once their weight shifts, you pull it back the other way. Tight dribbles, on the other hand, are those tiny rapid touches inside your own stance near your skates.
Which gives you maximum protection but minimal deception.
Right. You use tight dribbles in heavy traffic, along the boards, or when you are navigating the slot surrounded by sticks. Your body naturally shields a tight dribble.
But if you only ever handle tight, you can never stretch a defender to open up a passing lane.
Exactly. The true mastery comes from mixing the two seamlessly and, as you noted, breaking the lateral plane.
Yeah.
You must handle front to back, not just side to side.
Front to back? I always think of that motion as the cornerstone of the toe drag.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, if you can't confidently push the puck out in front of you and snap it backward toward your heels, you eliminate the most devastating moves in hockey.
The toe drag relies entirely on that deep front-to-back channel. And beyond flashy moves, front-to-back handling is how you survive side pressure.
How so?
Well, if a checker comes at you from the left, sweeping the puck further right might not be enough to get away from them. You often have to pull it backward, right into the protection of your skates. You have to train your hands to map the entire 360-degree reachable circle around your body.
Okay, so just to recap the foundation, we have the top hand as the steering wheel pushed off the chest to avoid hip lock. We have the bottom hand sliding dynamically to maintain soft hands. We have active wrists cupping the blade to fight the physics of the bouncing rubber. And we are utilizing the full 360-degree radius around our body.
That's the mechanical foundation, yes.
And if we drill these mechanics, we solve the physical problem of possession. But that leads us to a massive psychological shift, because all of these physical mechanics exist for one primary reason, and it is not to look good on a highlight reel.
No, they exist to free your eyes.
Yes. This is the golden rule, the absolute non-negotiable threshold of playing competitive hockey. If you have to look down at the puck to control it, you are not actually playing the game.
You are merely surviving the mechanics of possession. Mm. I mean, the source material we are pulling from today elevates this above literally every other skill.
It's the ultimate priority.
It is the ultimate coaching priority. Staring at the puck locks you out of the sport.
I liken it to typing on a keyboard. Like, if I am writing an essay and I have to stare down at my hands to find the F and the J keys, I am expending all my cognitive bandwidth on the mechanical act of typing.
Right, you're not thinking about the words.
I can't look at the screen. I can't think about the flow of my argument or the structure of my paragraphs or the overall narrative. I am functionally illiterate in that moment, just hunting and pecking.
That is a perfect translation of the cognitive load on the ice. Understanding the game arrives exclusively through your eyes.
What kind of data are we talking about here?
Think of the data you need to process in a split second. Say you are breaking out of your defensive zone. You need to read the angle of the F1 forechecker. You need to scan the neutral zone to see if the opposing defensemen are pinching or retreating.
Right.
You need to locate your center curling for support and calculate their speed so you can hit them in stride. Every single one of those crucial game-defining data points exists at eye level or higher.
So if your chin is down,
if your chin is pointed at the ice, watching the puck bounce on your blade, you have completely blinded yourself to the tactical landscape.
So why does staring at the puck ruin your tactical game? Just to retrieve that for our listeners.
Because you literally cannot read forechecks, find support, or hit moving teammates. It doesn't matter if your hockey IQ is off the charts. If the data never enters your brain, you can't process it.
Plus, there is a brutal, unforgiving physical reality to staring at your skates in a contact sport.
Oh, yeah. Puck watchers get hit, and they get hit violently.
Because they can't brace for it.
Exactly.
Okay.
If you are staring down, you cannot see the checker stepping up into your lane. You cannot brace for impact. You take the full force of a collision entirely unaware.
And that's how concussions happen.
That is exactly how concussions and shoulder separations happen. Your head has to be up for survival as much as for strategy.
But knowing that isn't enough, right? Like, a beginner out on the ice knows they should look up. The coach is screaming at them from the bench, head up, head up.
Sure.
So the player forces their chin up, looks down the ice, and immediately leaves the puck behind them. They lose it instantly, they panic, and they stare right back down.
Right back down.
So if looking up causes you to lose possession, how do you bridge that gap? Do you just force yourself to look up and accept that you're going to turn the puck over 100 times?
Well, it's a paradox. You cannot simply command your eyes to look up because the eyes are compensating for a lack of trust in the hands.
Wait, explain that.
The eyes look down because the brain needs confirmation that the puck is still there. To get the eyes up, you have to replace visual confirmation with tactile confirmation.
Tactile. So feeling it.
Yes. You have to build the physical feel of the blade.
How granular does that field need to get, though? Are we just talking about knowing it's generally somewhere on the stick?
Oh, much deeper than that. Elite players can feel exactly where the puck is sitting on the blade without looking.
Really?
Yeah. They feel the distinct vibrational difference between a puck resting on the toe of the blade, sitting dead in the middle, or jammed back by the heel. You build this by practicing slowly, explicitly mapping the sensation in your brain. You close your eyes in your driveway, roll the puck to the toe, and register that feeling traveling through the composite shaft right up into your top hand.
That neurological mapping is fascinating. It's like proprioception extended into a tool.
Exactly.
And once you start building that tactile map, what is the actual visual technique on the ice? I assume we aren't talking about pointing your nose at the rafters.
No, head up means eyes up and forward, scanning the horizon. You utilize your peripheral vision.
Okay.
The puck should sit at the very bottom edge of your sight line, just this blurry black shape moving in the lower third of your vision.
So you never look at it directly.
The transition technique is to peek, not stare.
Peek, not stare.
Right. As you are learning to trust your hands, you start with your eyes up, scanning. If you genuinely lose the tactile feel of the puck, you take a fraction of a second glance down to reset his position, and your eyes immediately snap back up.
Like checking a rearview mirror.
Exactly. You are checking the rearview mirror, not staring at the dashboard. Over time, as tactile trust grows, those peaks become shorter, rarer, and eventually unnecessary.
I know a lot of players try to build this off the ice on shooting pads in their garage or driveway. But a standard puck on a smooth plastic sheet is very predictable. Are there specific modalities to force the hands to learn faster than the eyes can track?
Yes. If you want to accelerate the tactile mapping, you have to introduce chaos. The source material heavily recommends using a golf ball or a tennis ball off the ice.
Because the physics of a sphere are entirely different than a flat cylinder.
Exactly. A golf ball bouncing on concrete is wildly unpredictable. It ricochets, it hops, it rolls over the blade. Your hands have to react in a millisecond to corral it.
And you can't just track that visually.
No, it moves far faster than your eyes can track it anyway, so you are forced to rely on the vibration traveling up the stick.
That makes total sense.
And the best part is, when you spend 20 minutes stick handling a golf ball, and then you step onto the ice with a standard 6-ounce puck, the puck suddenly feels enormous, incredibly heavy, and completely glued to your blade.
I've also seen that minefield drill where players scatter a dozen obstacles like old pucks or shoes across their handling area and try to navigate a stick handling ball through them without touching anything.
Oh, the minefield drill is brilliant because it hijacks your visual attention.
Right.
If you look at the ball you are handling, you will crash your stick into an obstacle. You are forced to look at the environment, solving the spatial puzzle with your eyes while your hands manage the possession subconsciously.
You're dividing the brain's focus.
Exactly. You can achieve a similar effect by stick handling while facing a wall with math equations on it, or a TV screen calling out the numbers or reading text out loud. If your brain is engaged in reading, it cannot be engaged in staring at the blade.
That's a great tip. But let me play devil's advocate regarding the transition from the driveway back to the rink. Because I practice all summer in my garage, right? My head is up, I'm reading the TV, I'm handling a golf ball like a pro. Then September hits, I step onto the ice, and I look like a beginner again.
Yeah, that happens a lot.
The puck feels foreign, I'm losing it in my skates, and my head immediately drops. It feels like the off-ice training was a lie.
It wasn't a lie, but it lacked environmental context. This is the 5 steps forward, 1 step back reality of motor learning.
What changes so drastically?
Well, off the ice, you are wearing shoes on a stable surface. On the ice, you are balancing on 2-millimeter-thick steel blades. That changes your center of gravity, your knee bend, and even the relative length of your stick.
Wow. Yeah, I didn't think about the stick length changing relative to the skates.
Plus, a puck on ice slides with vastly less friction than a ball on concrete. It is just going to feel different.
So that regression is entirely normal.
It is a completely necessary growing pain. You have to fight the instinct to stare back down. You have to accept that you will fumble the puck during those first few ice sessions.
That's tough for the ego.
It is. But enduring those turnovers with your head up is infinitely more valuable to your long-term development than flawlessly handling the puck while staring at your feet.
Mm-mm.
Which, as we said, is a developmental dead end.
I think that's a powerful reframing. Okay, so we've established the foundation of the hands and we've unlocked the vision of the eyes. But so far, we are picturing this happening in a vacuum, like a quiet rink, open ice, no pressure.
And hockey is never played in a vacuum.
Nope. It is played in a phone booth, surrounded by razor-sharp skates, swinging carbon fiber sticks, and 200-pound opponents trying to take your space.
Which pulls us into the absolute reality of traffic, small area control, and the incredibly complex geometry of the rulebook.
Yes. Let's talk about navigating congestion. When you are in the slot or battling along the wall, those wide sweeping dribbles we talked about earlier suddenly become a massive liability, right?
Absolutely. In open ice, a wide dribble moves the defender. In tight traffic, a wide dribble is just a gift-wrapped turnover.
Because there's no room.
Right. You are sticking the puck 3 feet away from your center of gravity right into a forest of opposing sticks. The fundamental principle of small area control is to shorten everything.
So you're operating entirely within that tight dribble framework we discussed.
Exactly. You handle the puck in the space you physically own.
And what defines that space geometrically?
Geometrically, that is usually the small, tight triangle formed by your two skates and the toe of your stick blade. You keep the puck trapped in that footprint, cupping it tightly.
Okay.
And critically, when pressure arrives in that tight space, your first physical instincts must be to turn away from it, not engage it.
Elaborate on that, because if a defender attacks my right side, my instinct is to stick handle the puck past his blade on the right side.
And that is exactly what the defender wants you to do.
Really?
Yeah. They want a stick-on-stick battle because they have the leverage advantage coming in. Instead of trying to beat their stick on the pressure side, you rotate your hips, pull the puck across your body to the far side, and put your back into them. You use your body as the shield.
Sometimes, though, despite your best efforts, the puck gets knocked off your blade and ends up chopped into your feet.
True.
And I watch beginners panic when the puck is in their skates. They start kicking wildly, looking down, completely losing their balance. But for an elite player, a puck in the feet isn't a lost possession at all. It's almost a safe haven.
It is a highly protected pocket. An opponent has a very difficult time extracting a puck from inside your stance without taking a penalty.
So you use your skates as walls.
Yes, you use your skates as walls.
Yeah.
If the puck drops between your feet, you angle your skate blade to trap it against the inside instep, shield it from the opponent's stick, and then smoothly kick it forward or backward onto your stick blade.
Okay, let's pause right here and dive into the deep end of the rulebook.
Okay, let's do it.
Because this concept of the skates being a safe haven brings up one of the most pervasive myths in all of hockey rinks. I hear players and parents scream this from the bleachers every weekend. He put his stick between my legs. That's an automatic penalty. The space between the skates is legally protected.
Oh, man. It is the most confidently shouted myth in the sport.
Wait, really? It's a myth.
Absolutely. There is zero geometric legal protection for the space between your skates. The phrase between the skates does not even exist in the NHL rulebook, the IIHF rulebook, USA Hockey or Hockey Canada.
A defender is entirely allowed to jam their stick between my legs to get the puck.
Yes. The act of placing a stick between an opponent's skates is completely legal. What triggers a penalty is not the location of the stick, but the effect it has on the puck carrier.
The outcome.
Right. The rule books judge the outcome, not the geometry.
Let's dissect how different leagues interpret that outcome then, because understanding this is crucial for risk management in tight spaces. Let's start with the NHL. What turns a stick in the skates into a penalty at the pro level?
Under NHL Rule 57.1, it becomes tripping if the stick actively brings you down. It must cause a fall.
A full fall.
Right. Alternatively, under Rules 55.1 and 56.1, it can be called hooking or interference. Even without a fall, if the stick is used to actively restrain you, tug you backward, or materially impede your ability to move freely.
So in the NHL, they have to either physically upend you or blatantly drag you backward like a water skier.
Exactly.
But what about the millions of amateur players listening to this? If I'm playing USA Hockey on a Sunday night, the standard has to be different, right?
It is significantly different, and this is where players get into trouble by watching NHL games and assuming the rules applied to their local league.
Okay. What's the USA Hockey rule?
Under USA Hockey Rule 639, the threshold for a tripping penalty is much lower. A complete fall to the ice is not required. A mere loss of balance caused by the stick can trigger a whistle.
So if a stick tangles my feet, I stumble, drop to one knee, but keep skating, that's a trip in USA Hockey.
Yes. However, if you don't fall completely, the USA Hockey casebook adds a very strict two-part condition for the referee to follow. It must be clearly obvious that your progress was impeded and that a competitive advantage was gained by the defending team.
Oh, competitive advantage.
Right. If a stick grazes your calf, you stumble slightly, but you maintain your speed and keep the puck, there is no competitive advantage gained by the defense, and therefore no penalty.
What about that very specific, very frustrating move where a defender slides their stick between your legs from behind and twists it, prying your skates apart? The can opener.
The can opener or corkscrew is specifically targeted by USA Hockey's standard of play. Placing the stick between the legs to cause a loss of balance or impede progress is explicitly named as a penalty.
Okay, good.
But, and this is a massive asterisk that puck carriers must understand, do not stand there waiting for a referee to save you.
Why not? If they specifically name it, shouldn't it be an automatic call?
Because USA Hockey Rule 639A carries a critical note. It explicitly states that no penalty shall be assessed if the referee judges that the defender was attempting to play the puck.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, if a defender legally poke checks the puck off your stick, and their momentum carries their stick into your skates, causing you to fall, it is perfectly legal.
So if it hit the puck first.
Exactly. The casebook reinforces this. Losing the puck to a clean check and then falling over the stick is not a penalty, unless the referee deems the defender intentionally followed through to trip you.
So the takeaway for the puck carrier is this. The geometric protection of your skates is a physical reality. It's hard for them to get the puck through your boots, but the legal protection is highly conditional.
Highly conditional.
You cannot rely on the referee. You have to rely on your balance.
Precisely. Now, since we are hyper-focused on the feet, we have to talk about kicking.
Right, kicking.
You mentioned kicking the puck up to your stick earlier. Kicking the puck to yourself is legal everywhere. But the line between kicking the puck and kicking a player is the most dangerous line in the rule book.
Because kicking a player isn't just a minor penalty. It is a catastrophic game-ending event.
It is an immediate ejection and usually comes with a lengthy suspension. The skate blade is a weapon.
Yeah.
Under NHL Rule 49.3, kicking or even attempting to kick an opponent is a match penalty.
Just attempting it.
Just attempting. A match penalty means you are thrown out of the game instantly, regardless of whether you actually made contact or caused an injury. USA Hockey and Hockey Canada mirror this match penalty severity.
What if you aren't trying to kick them with the blade, but just like using your boot to push them away in a scrum?
USA Hockey is so militant about this that using the skate to push off an opponent in a non-kicking motion is still a major penalty and a game misconduct.
Wow. And what about outside North America?
For listeners in Europe or the UK playing under IIHF rules, it's handled slightly differently in text. There is no specific match penalty phrasing, but the result is the same. Kicking an opponent is a major penalty at the referee's discretion, carrying an automatic game misconduct.
So the universal lesson across all leagues is that if you lose sight of the puck in your feet, do not blindly hack or swing your skates.
Exactly. If your blade catches an opponent's shin pad, your night is over.
Okay, let's call back to kicking the puck safely. I know I can kick it to my blade. Can I kick it into the net? I know a distinct kicking motion is illegal for a goal, but what about deflections?
This is another area where watching the NHL will get amateur players into deep trouble.
How so?
Under NHL and IIHF rules, you cannot score with a distinct kicking motion. However, if you kick the puck and it deflects off any player's stick, including your own teammate's stick, or even your own stick, and goes into the net, it is a good goal.
Oh, wait, so in the NHL, it's only waved off if it deflects off a body.
Exactly.
But I'm guessing USA Hockey and Hockey Canada don't allow that kind of pinball geometry.
They absolutely do not. Hockey Canada explicitly rules that a kicked puck deflecting off a teammate's skate, body, or stick is NO goal.
Zero tolerance.
Yep, and the USA Hockey casebook presents this exact scenario. Attacker kicks the puck, it deflects off their own stick and goes in. The ruling is a flat, unambiguous no goal.
So, in North American amateur hockey, the kick is strictly a utility move to regain possession, never a mechanism to create a goal.
Never.
This level of rulebook granularity is exactly what builds true hockey IQ. Knowing the physical laws of the ice is one thing. Knowing the legal laws dictates your risk management.
Absolutely.
Which brings me to a scenario that perfectly marries physics and rules, and it's one of the most misunderstood plays in the game. The pop-up puck.
Oh, the pop-up puck is chaos incarnate.
Right. A slap shot hits a shin pad, flutters into the air, and suddenly you have 10 players trying to track a projectile at eye level.
And the instinct for a player with good hand-eye coordination is to just reach out and grab it.
Is that legal?
Plucking the puck out of the air is perfectly legal in all major rule books. You are allowed to catch it. The illegality comes from what you do next.
You cannot keep it.
You cannot keep it. You have to drop it instantly.
It's radioactive.
Exactly. The NHL, IIHF, and Hockey Canada all explicitly grant permission to catch and immediately drop the puck. Interestingly, USA Hockey's playing rules don't actually print the permission in the main text.
Where is it?
You have to dig into the casebook, which dictates that the catch and the drop must be virtually one continuous motion.
What happens if I grab it, take two strides, and then drop it to avoid a check?
The whistle blows immediately for a hand pass or closing the hand on the puck. And under NHL and IIHF rules, if you catch it and skate to avoid a check, or if you pick a dead puck off the ice with your glove, you're getting a 2-minute minor for delay of game.
Okay, a minor penalty. But that minor penalty is nothing compared to the catastrophic mistake players make when this happens in their own end.
Ah, yes. The crease.
The crease. Let's talk about the crease.
If any skater, anyone who is not the heavily padded goaltender, falls on, holds, or closes their hand on a puck inside their own goal crease, they concede an automatic penalty shot to the opposing team.
This is universal.
This is universal across all four major rule books.
Let me make sure I'm hearing this right. I don't have to tackle a guy on a breakaway. I don't have to slash the stick out of someone's hands. If I just close my leather glove around a loose puck in the blue paint, I hand the other team a free one-on-one with my goalie.
Yes.
Wow.
And it gets worse.
How does it get worse?
If it's the end of the game and your goalie has been pulled for an extra attacker and you cover the puck in the crease to save a goal,
yeah.
The referee doesn't award a penalty shot. They award an automatic goal.
You just put the puck in your own net, legally speaking.
You did?
I want to use a visual analogy to map this out because the geometry here is wildly strict.
Okay, let's hear it.
I picture the goal crease not just as blue paint on the ice, but as an invisible high-security laser grid, like a vault in a heist movie.
Oh, I like that.
If I reach my hand through the laser grid and grab the diamond, the puck, the alarms go off, the penalty shot is awarded. But let me test the geometry of this vault.
Test away.
Let's say it's a frantic scramble. My skates are completely outside the blue paint. I am standing in the white ice, but I reach my arm into the blue paint and I close my hand on the puck. Do I beat the system because my body is out of the crease?
No. You set off the alarms. You give away the penalty shot.
Really? Even though I'm not standing in the crease?
This is the single most misunderstood nuance of the crease rule, and it is governed identically by the NHL, IIHF, USA Hockey, and Hockey Canada. The legal test is where the puck is, not where the player is.
Oh,
if the puck is inside the crease and you cover it, it is a penalty shot, regardless of where your boots are planted.
So what defines a puck in the crease when it's in the air? It's entirely dependent on the location of the rubber.
Entirely.
So conversely, if I am standing fully inside the blue paint, practically sitting on my goalie's lap, but I reach outside the crease and cover a puck in the white ice.
You only receive a standard 2-minute minor penalty for closing your hand on the puck, because the puck was outside the vault. The penalty shot requires the puck to be in the crease.
That is incredibly precise. But let's add the Z-axis. We were talking about the pop-up puck. The puck is in the air. How high does this laser grid vault go?
The crease is not a 2-dimensional painting on the ice. It is a 3-dimensional volume.
A volume?
Yes. All 4 rule books define the vertical ceiling of the crease as the top of the goal frame, specifically the crossbar, 4 feet off the ice.
So if a shot deflects, pops up to waist height, directly over the blue paint, and I pluck it out of the air and hold it.
You just grabbed a puck inside the 3D volume of the crease. Penalty shot.
Wow.
The IIHF Situation Handbook even outlines a specific case study to prove this exact point. A player catches a puck at waist height within the vertical projection of the crease and drops it outside the crease a second later. The ruling: because it was caught within the volume, the penalty shot applies.
What if it pops up over my head 6 feet in the air, higher than the crossbar, and I catch it there?
Technically, you have caught it outside the defined volume of the crease. It would only be a minor penalty for closing your hand on the puck.
That is a staggering level of real-time geometry for a referee to calculate.
It's extremely difficult for them.
The ultimate practical lesson for the listener here seems simple. If a puck pops up anywhere near your own net, do not try to be a hero. Do not catch it. Knock it straight down to the ice with an open palm in one continuous motion, or bat it away with your shaft.
Exactly. Do not force the referee to do 3D calculus in a split second, because if they guess wrong, it costs you the game.
Okay, we have survived the small area traffic and the legal minefield of the rule book, but navigating traffic eventually leads to physical conflict.
Yeah.
The opponent isn't just going to reach with their stick, you know. They're going to drive their shoulder through your chest.
Right. When the stick isn't enough, we have to introduce the body.
Which brings us to the art of survival, puck protection.
Yes. And every elite coaching curriculum ranks puck protection higher on the priority list than any deke, toe drag, or flashy move you will ever learn.
Why is that? Why is shielding the puck more valuable than dangling a defender?
Math. A highlight reel deke might present itself 2 or 3 times a game in open ice. Puck protection is required 30, 40, 50 times a game.
Every shift, basically.
Exactly. Every time a puck is dumped into the corner, every time a pass is received on the half wall, every time you enter the offensive zone and get stood up at the blue line. Protection is the gritty, unglamorous reality of where possession is actually won and retained.
So let's break down the biomechanics of protection. How do I turn my body into an impenetrable wall?
The absolute foundation is establishing the far side.
The far side.
Right. If a checker is approaching you from your right side, the puck must instantly move to your left side. Your torso becomes the physical barrier between the threat and the objective.
If we tie this back to the very beginning of our discussion, this is why hip lock is so fatal.
Precisely. If your hands are glued to your hips, you cannot reach the far side. You are forced to handle the puck in front of you on the pressure side.
And if it's on the pressure side?
If the puck sits on the pressure side, you are asking your stick blade to battle their stick blade, and they have the leverage advantage. When you extend your hands and pull the puck to the far side, a defender's poke check has to travel through your arm, through your torso, through your leg, and through your stick shaft just to reach the puck.
But just putting the puck on the other side isn't enough if the defender can just shove me off my feet. I need structural integrity.
You need a wide, low base. This is pure biomechanics and center of gravity.
So getting low.
Your feet must be wider than shoulder width, your knees deeply bent, and your hips sunk low. However, your chest must remain up so you can still scan the ice, tying back to our vision rules.
Because I see players standing tall like flagpoles trying to shield the puck, and they get absolutely launched into the boards.
Because a high center of gravity is inherently unstable. In a physical battle for space, leverage almost always defeats raw strength.
That's a good point.
A smaller, weaker player who drops their hips and establishes a wide base will consistently hold off a heavier, stronger player who is standing upright. Base is the one variable you entirely control.
But you can't just stand there, right?
No. Furthermore, that base cannot be static. You must keep your feet moving with small, choppy steps. A stationary target gets pinned. A moving target slides off the pressure.
I use a basketball analogy here. It's exactly like a center posting up in the paint.
Oh, that's a good one.
You don't back down a defender using your chest. You use your back, your hips, and your rear end. You want the thickest, widest parts of your body absorbing the force.
That is the exact anatomical strategy. Your back and your outside hip offer the widest surface area. If your chest is facing the defender, they can split your stance, reach between your arms, or knock you backward off your heel.
But if your back is to them...
If your back is to them, they are pushing against the natural forward drive of your skates. This is why you should almost never turn to face pressure the instant you receive a pass along the boards.
What should you do instead?
Take the puck, facing the glass or facing away, absorb the impending contact on your hip, establish your balance, and then spin off to make your play.
Okay, now in this posture, I'm leaning my back into the defender, my knees are bent, and I'm using one hand, my top hand, to control the puck on the far side of my body.
Right.
Which means I have a free hand. What are the rules of engagement for that free hand? Because my immediate instinct is to use it to stiff-arm the defender right in the chest to keep them away.
And that instinct will send you straight to the penalty box if you cross a very specific legal line.
So how do we legally use the free hand without taking a holding penalty? Just to recall that for the listener.
The rule book is incredibly delicate regarding the free hand. The overarching principle is this. Your free hand may momentarily fend off an opponent or their stick, but it may absolutely never hold, grab, tug, or pull them.
Does fend off mean I can push them?
That depends entirely on what league you are playing in.
Okay, break it down.
Let's look at the NHL, IIHF, and Hockey Canada first. They explicitly allow you to use a free hand to push away an opponent's body or block their stick, provided it is a momentary action and you don't wrap your fingers around them.
But USA Hockey is different.
USA Hockey is drastically more restrictive. In their playing rules, there is zero permission written to fend off a stick. The permission only exists hidden in their casebook, and it only applies to fending off the opponent's body, not their equipment.
Oh, I see.
And it comes with ironclad conditions. You must be in control of the puck, you must hold the position you have legally established, and this is the kicker, you cannot push off to create space.
Wait, stiff-arming a defender to create separation is a penalty in USA Hockey?
Yes. If you extend your arm and push the defender away to gain a foot of space, it is a holding minor. If you wrap your arm around their waist or clamp your arm over their stick against your body, it is a holding minor everywhere.
And in Canada?
Listeners in Canada should note, Hockey Canada takes holding so seriously that if your hold causes an injury, they escalate it to a major penalty and a game misconduct.
Wow. So if stiff-arming's a legal minefield, what is the best penalty-free habit to build for protecting the puck with that free arm?
You build an arm bar.
An arm bar, like in martial arts.
Kind of. Yeah. Instead of reaching out to touch the defender, you keep your free hand high on your own stick shaft, gripping it lightly or just resting against it.
Okay.
This creates a rigid triangle with your forearm and the stick shaft. You use this structure as a blocker. You absorb the contact against your own arm and stick.
So you're not actually touching them with your hand.
Exactly. It provides the exact same physical shield. It carries absolute zero officiating risk because you aren't touching the opponent with your free hand. And critically, it keeps both hands in the immediate vicinity of the stick.
So you're ready to pass or shoot?
Right. The millisecond that the defender falls away, your bottom hand is already in position to make a two-handed pass or shot.
That is an elite practical adjustment. Now, we have to transition to the most serious, gravest part of this entire discussion. In the outline for this masterclass, this concept is written in all capital letters. The safety override.
Yes, this is paramount.
We have talked about putting your back into the checker to win the leverage battle, but what happens when this battle drifts toward the boards? You're retrieving a puck, the boards are a foot away, and a checker is coming in hot.
Right.
If taking a hit on my hip means I lose the leverage battle and lose the puck, shouldn't I just quickly turn my back to the wall to shield it or duck under the hit to maintain possession?
Never. Under absolutely no circumstances.
Really? Not even once?
The rule of the safety override supersedes every tactical advantage, every possession metric, and every instinct to win the battle. When you are within 3 feet of the boards, you never turn your back to the play. And you never, ever duck.
We need to break down the biomechanics and the physics of those two specific actions because players do them constantly without understanding the risk. Why are those two movements so absolute?
Let's start with turning your back. When you turn your back to the boards as a checker is arriving, you instantly convert a routine shoulder-to-shoulder collision into a hit from behind.
Which is incredibly dangerous.
You remove your ability to see the impact coming. If you can't see it, you can't brace your muscles, you can't adjust your edge work to absorb the force, and you get violently pitched headfirst into the glass.
Wow.
USA Hockey's safety curriculum explicitly warns that even a light accidental shove from behind when you are in that vulnerable posture can inflict severe head and neck trauma.
And what about ducking? Because ducking feels evasive. It feels like you're making yourself a smaller target to slip the check.
Ducking is the single most insidious, dangerous reflex in the sport. It is the primary mechanical cause behind almost all on-ice cervical spine injuries, broken necks, and paralysis.
Why is that?
We have to look at the anatomy of the spine to understand why. The human neck, the cervical spine, has a natural slight backward curve called lordosis.
Okay, lordosis.
This curve acts like a shock absorber. If you hit your head while looking up and forward, the neck flexes, the muscles absorb the energy, and the spine bends safely.
But when you duck, you change that alignment.
Exactly. When you duck your head in anticipation of a hit, you tuck your chin toward your chest. This action, called cervical flexion, straightens out that natural curve.
It makes it straight.
It snaps the fragile vertebrae of the neck into a perfectly straight, rigid column. If you suffer a headfirst collision with the boards, the glass, or an opponent's chest in that posture, the spine cannot bend to absorb the force.
So where does the force go?
The energy travels straight down the rigid column in what is called axial loading. The vertebrae compress against each other and shatter.
But surely that kind of catastrophic structural failure requires massive kinetic energy, right? That only happens if an NHL player is flying in at 25 miles an hour and drives someone into the wall.
That is the most terrifying and tragic misconception in hockey, and it's why we opened this discussion the way we did. The medical research, specifically the landmark Pater study on spinal injuries in hockey, which is the foundation of USA Hockey's Heads Up, Don't Duck, program states explicitly that catastrophic axial loading failure can occur at walking speed.
3 or 4 miles an hour.
Yes. If your neck is straightened into flexion, the mass of your own body sliding into the boards at a walking pace is enough kinetic energy to compress and break the cervical spine.
It doesn't require a violent hit.
It does not require a violent hit from a goon. It simply requires bad posture and a solid object.
So how do we survive the boards? What is the legally and physically safe posture when you are retrieving a puck and a hit is inevitable?
You prioritize the safety override over possession. You get your skates parallel to the wall, not pointing at it.
Yeah.
You take the contact on your forearm, your shoulder, and the outside of your hip.
Skates parallel to the wall.
Yes. You keep your head up, your chest tall, and you ensure your chin is off your chest so the natural curve of your neck remains intact.
What if I'm already facing a wall and I don't have time to turn parallel?
If you are already facing the wall and you realize you cannot turn your body in time to take it on the hip, USA Hockey's fallback technique is to spread the load.
How do you spread the load?
Put your stick and your gloves up flat against the glass.
Mm-hmm.
Keep your arms slightly bent to act as shock absorbers and ensure absolutely zero head contact with the boards.
A hockey possession is never, ever worth a broken neck. That is the one rule that matters above all others today.
That is the only rule that truly matters.
Okay, taking a deep breath.
Yeah, that's a heavy one, but so important.
It is. Okay, so we have covered the physics of the hands, the cognitive load of vision, the rule book geometry of tight spaces, and the biomechanics of survival on the boards. But eventually, you break out of that traffic. You find open ice. And hockey is a game defined by speed.
Yes, speed. Let's open up the stride.
Let's talk about moving with purpose, carrying the puck at speed and attacking a defender one-on-one.
And this is where we see the most frustrating phenomenon in amateur hockey. The deceleration problem.
A deceleration problem.
A player executes a brilliant breakout, receives a tape-to-tape pass in full stride through the neutral zone, and the moment the puck hits their blade, they stop skating.
Right. They slow down to a comfortable jogging pace, they start stick handling rapidly side to side, and they hand the defense 2 free seconds to close the gap.
It is maddening to watch.
Why do they do it? Why do players voluntarily surrender their most valuable asset speed the moment they get the puck?
Because the human brain struggles to multitask complex motor functions. Skating at top speed requires massive arm drive, deep knee bend, and forward weight distribution.
And stick handling requires the opposite.
Exactly. Stick handling requires quiet upper body movement, wrist rotation, and visual scanning. The brain gets overwhelmed and defaults to prioritizing the new task handling the puck.
So they stop pumping their arms.
The arms stop driving because they are fussing with the stick. The head drops to look at the puck, which pulls the body weight forward onto the toes, killing the extension of the skating stride.
So how do we marry the two? How do we carry the puck without sacrificing a single mile per hour of velocity?
You follow a simple rule. Carry, don't dribble.
Carry, don't dribble. I like that.
When you are moving at speed in open ice, you should not be stick handling every single step. You are not a basketball point guard. Instead, you push the puck slightly ahead of you, slightly to the side, usually on your forehand.
Just push it and leave it.
You push it out into space. You take two or three massive driving crossovers to catch up to it. You give it one soft touch to correct its trajectory, and you push it out again.
I love this visualization. The puck and the player are taking separate parallel journeys down the ice. They just meet up every 20 feet.
Exactly. You only touch the puck enough to keep the defender honest, preventing them from timing a poke check. Otherwise, you let your legs do the work.
What's the elite version of this?
The absolute elite version of this is pushing the puck into contested space and skating onto it. If a defender is perfectly positioned, sealing your lane with their body and stick, you don't try to stick handle through them.
You chip it.
You chip the puck off the glass, pass them on one side, you accelerate around their body on the other side, and you reunite with the puck behind them. You do not need magical hands to beat a defender if the puck goes one way and you go the other.
Okay, but what if I want to use magical hands? The chip and chase is effective, but sometimes you have the defender isolated and you want to execute a deke. I always compare a successful deke to a stage magician's misdirection.
Oh, how so?
The trick isn't in the sleight of hand, it's in the body language that sells the illusion.
That is the perfect analogy, because a deke is, fundamentally, a false signal. A defender cannot wait to see what you actually do, because human reaction time is too slow.
So they have to guess?
They have to read your intent before you act. They read your hips, your shoulders, your eyes, and your weight transfer.
Which means if I just skate straight at them, perfectly upright, and wiggle my stick back and forth really fast,
you achieve absolutely nothing. Moving the puck laterally while your torso remains square and neutral gives the defender zero false information. They ignore your stick, watch your chest, and stand you up.
So what makes it work?
To execute a successful deke, you must commit your entire body to the lie. A half-hearted shoulder dip fools no one. You have to physically load your weight onto your outside edge as if you were genuinely driving that direction. Your shoulders must drop, your hips must turn, your eyes must look toward the fake space.
You have to convince their central nervous system that the threat is real.
Yes. The outline categorizes this into four channels of deception. First, head and eyes. A sharp look off where you stare intently at a passing option you have no intention of using freezes the defender's feet.
Because they think a pass is coming.
Right. Second, shoulders and hips. A heavy weight shift is the most convincing fake because it carries the physical momentum of your body.
Okay.
Third, stick and puck. Faking a shot by changing the blade angle and winding up forces the defender to brace for an impact that never comes. Fourth, feet and edges. A stutter step or a change of pace that attacks their timing.
Now, why do defenders fall for changes in speed more than changes in direction? Let's quickly review that.
Because defenders guard direction, well, they simply angle you off, but timing poorly. If you bait them by slowing down and then explode, you use their own momentum against them.
Let's talk about attacking the defender's position. The conventional wisdom is that you never attack a defender squarely in the chest.
If you attack their chest, they remain perfectly balanced, they keep both escape lanes closed, and they simply absorb you. You must attack a shoulder.
Why a shoulder?
Attacking a shoulder forces the defender to pivot their skates and turn their hips. The millisecond their hips turn to match your angle, a lane opens up that did not exist a moment before.
But let me push back on this defensively. Is there an absolute rule on which shoulder to attack? If I'm coming down the wing, should I always attack the outside shoulder near the boards or the inside shoulder near the middle?
There is no universal law. It is a high-speed game of chess, and it depends on your speed advantage and your coach's system.
Okay, let's walk through both. Outside shoulder first.
If you attack the outside shoulder, the one nearest the boards, you force the defender to open their hips toward the wall. This opens a massive, tempting lane for you to cut back underneath them into the middle of the ice.
That sounds ideal. I want the middle of the ice.
It is ideal for you, but be warned. Steering you toward the wall and allowing you to cut back is exactly what a well-coached defenseman is trained to do.
Really? Why would they want that?
Because they know they have a back-checking center coming to hit you the moment you cut back. The outside is considered the less dangerous ice.
So what happens if I attack the inside shoulder instead?
Driving directly at the inside shoulder threatens the most dangerous real estate on the rink, the high slot. The defender must respect that threat.
So they shift their weight inside.
Right. They have to shift their weight heavily to the inside to protect the house. The moment they overcommit to the inside, you explode to the outside, down the boards.
What's the downside?
The trade-off is that by attacking the inside initially, you are skating directly into the teeth of the defensive structure. You have to read the ice to know which shoulder is vulnerable.
And reading the ice brings us to the final and arguably most important strategic lesson of this entire masterclass. We have spent an hour dissecting the physics, rules, and biomechanics of how to stick handle. But the true hallmark of mastery is knowing when to leave the tool in the toolbox.
The anti-skill, risk management, knowing when absolutely not to stick handle.
So what does this all mean? The irony here is that the ultimate lesson of a puck handling masterclass is learning how to quickly and efficiently get rid of the puck.
It is the definition of hockey IQ. Every time you attempt to deke a defender, you are running a mathematical risk of a turnover.
And sometimes that cost is just too high.
Exactly. There are specific zones and situations on the ice where the cost of that turnover vastly outweighs any potential reward.
Let's map out the never zones. Where is stick handling strictly forbidden? What are the three situations where you should never attempt a deke? Let's retrieve those.
First and foremost, you never stick handle in your own defensive zone, and you never try to dangle a forechecker through the middle of the ice in your own end.
Now, if I'm a highly skilled forward, doesn't my team want me to take risks to create offense? Like, the ice is open, I can beat this guy. Why is it forbidden?
Because the penalty for failure is catastrophic. The middle of your defensive zone is the most high-danger area on the rink.
If you lose it there.
If you attempt a toe drag at the hash marks and lose the puck, it lands directly on the stick of an opposing forward in the slot, 15 feet from your goalie, with zero time for your defense to recover. You also have no boards to use as a safety valve.
So what's the right play?
The absolute rule in the D zone is to get the puck moving north safely. Make a hard pass, rim it around the glass, reverse it behind the net, or simply chip it out to the neutral zone. No professional coach in the history of the sport has ever benched a player for executing a clean, boring defensive zone exit.
What about offensive situations? Say we are on a two-on-one rush. I am an elite stick handler. I know I can undress the defenseman. Shouldn't I take the risk to create a highlight reel goal?
If a pass is available to your teammate, absolutely not. If you break one habit after listening to this deep dive, break the habit of dangling when a pass is open.
Why is the pass always superior to the deep?
Three reasons in physics and geometry. One, a puck sliding on the ice moves infinitely faster than any human being can skate or stick handle. The pass beats the defender's reaction time.
Okay, two.
Two, a pass completely removes the puck from the vicinity of the defender's stick, eliminating the risk of a poke check entirely. Three, a pass forces the opposing goaltender and the entire defensive structure to shift laterally. Moving a goalie side to side opens up vastly more net than beating a single defenseman ever could. A simple flat pass to a teammate in a slightly worse position is almost always a mathematically superior play to trying to deke a squared up defender.
What about situations where I'm outnumbered? I'm trapped on the wall, one guy's pinning me, and a second guy is... And there is one final scenario that dictates absolute restraint. What if I am the last player back? I'm a defenseman. I've got the puck at the offensive blue line. A forward is rushing at me, and I have no teammates behind me.
If you lose the puck and it results in a completely uncontested breakaway against your goaltender, the deke is off. Always.
Even if I have great hands.
It does not matter. If you have the best hands in the league, the risk profile is unacceptable. You chip the puck deep, you pass it, or you dump it into the corner. You live to fight another shift.
Which perfectly highlights how puck handling isn't a monolith. Different positions demand different applications of these mechanics, don't they?
Exactly. The biomechanical foundation, the grip, the vision, the base is universal. But a defenseman uses those mechanics to handle the puck laterally across the blue line or to execute elite puck protection during a corner retrieval with a heavy forecheck bearing down.
And wingers?
A winger uses those mechanics to win the 50-50 battle on the half wall and carry the puck at top speed through the neutral zone.
And centers.
A center uses those mechanics to draw defenders toward them in the middle of the ice, creating gravity, before distributing the puck to the open wings. A center who constantly dangles into triple coverage is a center who fundamentally misunderstands their role in the ecosystem.
That ecosystem is the perfect way to frame this. We have built an incredible structure here today. We started with the friction of the fingers on the composite shaft, and we've scaled all the way up to the strategic architecture of the entire ice sheet.
We really have covered a lot of ground.
So as we wrap up this masterclass, pull all these threads together for us. How should a listener integrate this into one coherent mental model?
I want you to conceptualize everything we've discussed as a hierarchy of leverage. It is a ladder you climb. Good hands, the soft grip, the cupped blade, avoiding hip lock, the wide reach are merely the first rung.
The first rung.
Yes. They are a lever for your vision. They exist so you can stop staring at the rubber. That vision, the second rung, dictates your tactics. It allows you to process the chaos, see the passing lanes, and map the ice.
And then the third rung.
Your body positioning, the low base, placing the puck on the far side, putting your back into the checker, is the third rung. It dictates your physical safety and allows you to retain possession when the chaos closes in on you.
Right.
And finally, sitting at the very top of the hierarchy is your brain. Your hockey IQ dictates your restraint, knowing that all of these incredible mechanical skills are ultimately tools of last resort, and that a simple, perfectly timed pass is the true mark of mastery.
If the listener is driving to the rink right now and they can only hold five core principles in their head when they step onto the ice, what are the five pillars of this mental model?
Okay, here they are. Pillar one, the top hand sears, the bottom hand slides. Be dynamic and never white knuckle the shaft.
Sure.
Pillar two, build the tactile feel of the puck so your eyes can stay up. Vision dictates everything else in the game.
Pillar three.
Pillar three. In traffic, put the puck on the far side, drop your base, and put your back into the checker. But remember, the absolute safety override near the boards, never turn your back, and never duck. Pillar four. A deke is a full body illusion, not a hand trick. Commit with your shoulders, attack a specific angle, and accelerate out of the move.
And the final one?
Pillar five. Strategic restraint. Pass the puck if a teammate is open. Speed and passing beat hands every single time.
An incredibly powerful synthesis. And to bring this full circle, you know, we started by talking about the invisible architecture of the sport. We talked about how you can't just draw a perfect blueprint on a sheet of ice with 10 players moving at 20 miles an hour.
Right, the chaos factor.
But what you can do is master the micro mechanics that buy you time within that chaos. So I want to leave you, the listener, with a provocative thought. Piece of homework for the next time you turn on the television to watch an NHL game.
Oh, a shift in perspective.
Exactly. When you watch the game, the broadcast camera, the announcers, the crowd, they all want you to follow the puck. They want you to stare at the little black disc. I challenge you to ignore it entirely.
That's a great exercise.
Watch the puck carrier's eyes. Watch how constantly they are scanning the horizon. Watch their shoulders and their hips as they approach a defender to see the false signals they broadcast.
And watch their base.
Yes. Watch how they manipulate their base along the boards. And most importantly, watch exactly when the most skilled, highly paid athletes in the world choose not to stick handle and instead make a simple, mathematically perfect pass to relieve pressure.
Because if you stop watching the puck and start watching the mechanics of possession, you will suddenly see the blueprint hidden beneath the chaos.
You will see an entirely different game.
It really demystifies the magic and reveals the mastery.
It truly does. Well, thank you for taking this deep dive with us today, for letting us dissect the mechanics, the physics, and the rule book of this incredible sport. Keep your head up, keep your stick on the ice, and we'll see you out there.